Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 304 for February 19th, 2011. I'm still on the road this week in central Indiana. I'll explain more later on. In the meantime,
I think ultimately I'd like to see a section in a liquor store that says craft spirits, artisan spirits, you know, whatever you want to call it, because to me, there's a difference with what they're doing.
That's Matt Colglazier, the author of the American Craft Spirits blog, and also the marketing manager of the liquor stores that I frequented while I was studying many years ago at Indiana University, Big Red Liquors in Bloomington, Indiana. Since then, Big Red has gotten very serious about whiskey and now stocks more than 200 different whiskeys from all over the world. More with Matt on whiskey and other craft spirits in a few minutes, but first, let's look at the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. I've focused on Canadian whiskeys a lot over the last few weeks. There's another new one on the market to talk about. Collingwood comes from Brown-Forman and is produced at the company's Canadian Mist Distillery in Ontario. It's unique because of the toasted maple wood finish, which no other Canadian whiskey has. It's bottled at 40% ABV. Collingwood will be available in four U.S. states at first: Kentucky, Florida, Texas, and Louisiana, with more markets coming later this year. Last year, the Dalmore released its Clan Mackenzie expression, with part of the proceeds destined to help restore Castle Loud, the ancestral home of the Mackenzies. The 3,000 bottles of Clan Mackenzie sold out in less than 9 months, and the Dalmore is following up with a new expression named after Castle Loud, which is located just 14 miles away from the distillery in the Scottish Highlands. The expression carries no age statement, but did spend the final 18 months of maturation in French oak Bordeaux barrels. The Dalmore Castle Loud will carry a suggested retail price of £100, or about $160 at current exchange rates. I've mentioned Knob Creek's new single barrel release and had tasting notes for it on Whiskey Cast several weeks ago. It is now available at retailers. Also, Master of Malt is releasing a new Speyside whiskey-based liqueur, and Jack Daniel's has had a ready-to-go Jack and Cola drink available in export markets for years now. It is now making it available in the U.S. for the first time. Heaven Hill's $5 million expansion project reached another milestone this week when the second of two new rickhouses was dedicated at its Bardstown headquarters. Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear helped Heaven Hill President Max Shapiro roll the first barrel into the new rickhouse. The company now has 49 rickhouses with a capacity of around 900,000 barrels of whiskey. Finally, the whiskey show in London has been an autumn highlight the last 2 years, but there has been a very public split between the show's two partners. The Whiskey Exchange and Graham Wallace's GW Publishing had teamed up to promote the first two shows, but this week the Whiskey Exchange took great pains to announce that it has ended its partnership with Wallace and will instead organize a new show at London's Vinopolis on October 7th and 8th. That's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. Let's check the emails of the week now, brought to you by the Singleton of Glendullen. As I mentioned earlier, I'm in central Indiana again this week. It's where I grew up. My parents still live here. My father was diagnosed a couple of weeks ago with lung cancer and started chemotherapy and radiation treatments this past week. I'd like to thank everyone who has emailed or posted messages of support on the Whiskey Cast Facebook page. Right now, the outlook is pretty good, but it's just the start of the fight, and your messages have been a great comfort. Meanwhile, Ed Hertel posted this note on the Whiskey Cast Facebook page. Mark, as always, thanks for the great podcast and website. It has been the biggest contributor to my whiskey education. However, I want to step it up even more, and was wondering if you might have a recommendation on a 1 to 3 day immersive whiskey experience in Scotland you might recommend. I know some of the distilleries give these classes occasionally, but I'm having a hard time locating them online. Any help pointing me in the right direction would be appreciated. Well, Ed Springbank's schedule of classes for the year was full the last time I checked, and Brooke Laddie has stopped offering its whiskey school on Isla. The Glenlivet has a 3-day whiskey school scheduled in May, and it's always worth checking out the Bladnock website, since Raymond Armstrong offers whiskey schools at the distillery from time to time, along with Wild Scotsman's Jeff Topping. If anyone else has suggestions, post them on the Whiskey Cast Facebook page, or you can email me directly. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com, and the emails of the week are brought to you by the Singleton of Glendullen, 12-year-old Speyside single malt scotch whiskey, aged in both American bourbon oak and European sherry oak casks. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you, as always, by Laphroaig. Last time around, we heard from Ryan Maloney at Julio's Liquors in Westboro, Massachusetts. Julio's Whiskey A Go-Go event is coming up next Sunday on the 27th, along with Whiskey Live Seoul in South Korea. Dramfest 2011 is also this coming weekend in Christchurch, New Zealand. Whiskey Live London is the weekend of March 4th and 5th. The Astor Center in New York City will hold a special Whiskey and Women event again this year on March 8th, which is International Women's Day. Bonhams in Edinburgh, Scotland will hold its next whiskey auction on the 9th, and the Whiskey Guild's annual Whiskey Classic Tasting will be on March 10th in Morristown, New Jersey. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Just click the Laphroaig banner at the WhiskeyCast website to become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla. Now, several months ago, Matt Colglazier interviewed me for his American Craft Spirits blog. Matt lives in Bloomington, Indiana. It's a place I'm very familiar with since I spent 4 years in Bloomington getting my degree in communications at Indiana University. Turns out that in addition to his blog, Matt is also the marketing director for another place in Bloomington that I became quite familiar with. Back in the day, I used to pick up kegs of beer at Big Red Liquors for weekend parties. To be honest, that was a long time before I developed a passion for whiskey, and Big Red's selection wasn't very good back then anyway. Now Big Red gets featured in Malt Advocate magazine's list of retailers that stocks more than 200 different kinds of whiskey. I remember coming here as an undergrad many, many years ago. I won't say exactly how many, but there was not as nearly much of a whiskey selection here as there is now. What went into building this all up? Because you've got an entire row full of whiskeys from literally almost all over the world. There's even some Japanese stuff here, a lot of Kentucky, a lot of bourbons, a lot of scotches, and some good Canadians too, right?
Yeah, I think we've just have smarter consumers. We have students, which of course are still buying Keystone Light and, you know, whatever. That's sort of driving a lot of our sales. But then we've also got professors and young professionals in this town who, as the sort of foodie culture has grown up, they're also interested in craft spirits and wanting to, you know, different rums, you know, more exotic liqueurs, and just knowing where the products are from and that they can get them here, that they don't have to drive up to Indy or they don't have to drive up to Chicago and to get those things, that we can bring them in here if that's what they're interested in, and provide some education, provide some background. And yeah, I mean, probably IU in the, let's say, 70s, you know, you wouldn't see that around here. It was mostly just beer. So it's grown up.
I wouldn't go to the 70s. I wouldn't know about that. I was underage in the 70s. But let's talk about the selection, because you've got everything from the base end whiskeys at $10 a bottle, all the way up to the last drop at $2,000 a bottle, and whiskeys in that range, right?
We do. I mean, that's a part of it. We want to cater to all our customers. So, you know, maybe we've got a dad in town, daughter's graduated from IU after 7 years, 8 years. Who knows? Maybe he'll go for the last drop.
If he can afford it at the price, because tuition here is a hell of a lot more expensive now than it was when I was coming here.
Yeah, just a little bit more, exactly. But maybe if he's not paying tuition for the next year, then maybe he can splurge a little bit. But yeah, we try to carry a range of whiskeys. And, you know, a lot of our consumers are pretty savvy on single malts, even though, you know, as you know, the prices on those have just gone up astronomically. But we also, you know, there's so many good values to be found in American whiskey, and we try to carry as much of that as possible.
What's the most underrated whiskey that you'd find here? I found a few that I've not seen anyplace else when I was looking through the shelves.
This is available widely, but people still don't know about it, is the Evan Williams Single Barrel. Mm-hmm. We get that in, and, you know, it can sit on the shelf for a while, and people see Evan Williams, and they know about the other Evan Williams, which is good whiskey. I saw John Hansel had rated that as best buy for the year, but those single barrels are so good, and for $25, which is our price point here, it's a knockout. And I just tell people, actually, there was a guy that came in the other day, and he was like, what's the best bourbon I could get for $25? And I said, here's the best bourbon. And I started, you know, going on and on about how good it was and the flavor profile, etc. And he goes, thanks, I just broke up with my girlfriend. So, you know, I mean, that's a good example of, you know, maybe looking at the customer and seeing on his face. But hopefully he had a good bourbon experience at least. But, you know, that's my go-to bottle always.
If he remembers it, of course.
I hope he remembers it. And I hope he drank, you know, a reasonable amount that night.
What are some of the more unusual bottles that you'd find here? For instance, I found one, a Goederham & Wirtz bottle from the old distillery in Toronto in the Canadian side that I hadn't seen even in Canada that you guys had on the shelf here.
Yeah, we carry some different things. Like the Pussers I don't see everywhere as a rum we carry.
One of the things I noticed is that you also do a lot with the micro distillers, and this sort of goes into your wheelhouse with running the American Craft Spirits blog. You guys have a healthy emphasis on the micro distillers here too, right?
Yeah, we do. Those are kind of coming from both ends. It's from distributors who are saying, you know, we've picked up this product. It's pretty small, but you know, would you carry a couple cases of this and see if it has any legs in the store? But then also customers who will travel, who will go to Washington, who will go to Oregon. Anybody who's been to Portland certainly knows about craft spirits, and then they come back and they say, well, can you get this? Can you get this? And we try to bring that in. We were talking about Death's Door white whiskey, which, you know, it's not for everybody, but we sell a few bottles, and it sort of piques people's interest, not just in that particular product, but in the range of products that you know, we're calling craft spirits or micro distilleries.
And in the guise of being a college town, and really that sort of experience helps to educate some of your younger and newer whiskey consumers, right?
It does, and I think when you're talking about craft spirits, you're also you can show people literally how the products are made. You know, when you say white whiskey, well, if you're buying that or you're selling that, you know, there's some knowledge that's passed on there. Well, whiskey gets all of its color and a lot of its flavor from the barrel itself, so you know, there you go. I mean, they're learning something when they're buying that product. And same with a lot of the other craft spirits. It's like, okay, this is a year in oak. This is 2 years in oak. This is 5 years in oak. And on down the line, so you can see how flavor develops in the barrel. And I think we have some consumers who are pretty interested in that, actually.
Now, I know the draconian pre-prohibition Indiana state liquor laws don't allow you to do a lot of shipping, but you can do in-store tastings at least, right?
We can do in-store tastings. It's like a half ounce for spirits and 2 or 3 ounces for wine. We do wine tastings on a regular basis, and then we tend to do spirit tastings whenever a new product comes in or something that somebody asked or is really interested in is, you know, or, you know, anybody wants to promise to buy a case, you know, we'll open a we'll maybe taste them on that. So, yeah, we can do tastings here. And I think those laws are starting to loosen up a bit. But yeah, it's still a fairly conservative state. So,
and one of the whiskeys I know you've been doing a lot of tastings for recently is the W.H. Harrison Indiana Bourbon, which is said to be the first bourbon produced in Indiana since Prohibition. I know there, as we've discussed, there are some distillers down along the Ohio River that may be making bourbons, but this is the first one to be branded as an Indiana bourbon under an Indiana label, right?
Right. Jerry Knight, who's the founder of this company, has come out with two different bourbons, sort of a regular bottling of W.H. Harrison bourbon, and then they have a reserve. And I really like both of them, personally. I know Jerry worked for Crown Royal for a while, and I think if you look at the first one and you kind of parse out that flavor profile, you can see that a little more light, a little more elegant whiskey is a good thing, that he likes that. And then the Reserve, which is a heavy rye recipe, and is it barrel proof. So, you know, you really can't go wrong there. It's a pretty bulletproof bourbon. So we like both of them. And I think it attests to the fact that people want to drink local products, local spirits. And, you know, sometimes it's in the guise of somebody who's bottling a product, you know, that's distilled in Indiana, and sometimes that's in the guise of somebody who's, you know, using a Colonel Vaughn special still and, you know, making a 10-gallon batch and aging it for 6 months. I mean, it runs the gamut, but that's certainly a product that's been popular here, and we, you know, beyond just enjoying it ourselves, we like telling people about it. There's an Indiana bourbon. Here you go. So when you have a dad from New York, or, you know, a mom from the West Coast coming here to see their kid, you know, you could say, oh, I want to try something from Indiana. Well, now we have that product here, and we can give them that bottle. So
which in the past was limited otherwise to some really lousy wines that were made in Indiana.
Well, yeah, and the wines are getting better too. So, you know, well, you're from New Jersey, so.
No, I'm from Indiana originally. I grew up about 60 miles from here, and I remember the infamous Oliver Winery up north of here. Yeah. With the honey wine that was just absolutely atrocious, and some of the other wines that back 20, 30 years ago were just wines in name only. I mean, they were of the Boone's Farm quality, I would think, almost. But that's also gotten strong too, right?
That's gotten a lot better. And actually, I will say for Oliver, they've got a Creek's Bend, which is all like estate grown wines now that, you know, for their price point, those are really great wines. And you know, Butler, which is a small family winery that's been around here for a long time. They're making some pretty decent juice. And, you know, again, sometimes that's going to be hit or miss. I mean, in Indiana climate, you could have a super hot summer, a super wet summer, and you've really got to pay attention to the grapes. But the more people are interested in that, I feel like the producers get better as the tastes of their consumers get better. I mean, those go hand in hand to me. So,
and as they get more practice, too.
And as they get more practice, and they've been here long. I mean, you know, you're remembering Oliver from a while back, and they've just gotten better and better every year. It's just like anybody who does it.
And it's not fair to criticize them. I just remember the early days of just some really nasty stuff. And to be fair, there are some whiskey distilleries that, when they first got started, put out some really lousy stuff, too, at the beginning.
Yeah, people put out bad juice all the time. Breweries, wineries, spirits makers. And, you know, as from the retail side of things, I mean, we try to parse through that and say, okay, well, you know, maybe not this year, guys, but... you know, for a large part, we try to carry the stuff that we think is good, that we would drink, that we would recommend to our family. So
let's talk about your blog also, the American Craft Spirits blog, because this gets back into the wheelhouse again with the micro distillers and the drinking locally movement and this whole explosion we've seen in little small craft distilleries all over the country. What are you working on with the blog these days?
Tasting a lot of product and reviewing a lot of product and trying to keep up with, you know, what's happening. And, you know, I think I get an update every probably 6 hours of a distillery that I've never heard of that's either applying for a license or in the process or bottling their first run. And so, you know, all of those producers are really excited to get the news out. And so they'll contact me, I'll contact them. But yeah, that movement is happening like right now, like every day, new product, new ideas, and people are developing things. So to me, that's pretty exciting, actually. And, you know, is it going to – I think ultimately I'd like to see a section in a liquor store that says craft spirits, artisan spirits, you know, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. Because to me, there's a difference with what they're doing. Now, a flavor profile, that's going to always be up for debate. But in terms of – what a consumer is interested in looking at, what a consumer wants, you know, that they'd like to see, I think, a delineation between craft spirits and some of the big boys. And it's also driving some of the larger producers to make products that appeal in that same way to people.
That would be stuff like, for instance, the Makers 46, which has, as we've covered on the show many times before, that unique wood finish to it from some new toasted staves that basically just sort of gives it a little bit of a different flavor from regular Makers, but it's the kind of stuff that you'd find in a craft whiskey.
Right, and I think John Glazer has been experimenting with stave inserts for a long time, and so you see somebody like that who is he's not small really, but you know, smaller than Jim Beam. And then Maker's Mark is doing some inserts with, I think, seared French oak.
Yeah, something, or the seared, different toast on the oak they're using. So right. It's a different toast. It's a toast as opposed to a char.
Yeah, and that's great. I mean, they're not, you know, that's, you know, for them, that's still a mass-produced product, but not quite as mass-produced as, let's say, regular Maker's Mark, which I still really like, and it's been my mother's bourbon for, you know, forever and a day. So, that's what... If it's doing that, if it's driving some of the longer time producers to experiment, and then it's also setting up maybe a new drinks category that people can feel comfortable going to because they like that flavor profile, then that's a good thing.
Matt, let me put you on the spot here. Give me three recommendations for craft spirit whiskeys that people might not have heard of or that they'd have to actually go looking really hard to find.
I think Mosby's Rye Spirit from Catoctin Creek in Virginia is my favorite. Followed fairly closely by a grouping of like the rye and the millet spirits that Koval makes in Chicago. Those two right there, I think, are making the best white whiskey in the country right now. And so you're talking about fairly small, very local Virginia, Chicago area distributions that hopefully will grow over time. And as people taste the products, you know, they'll say, oh, okay, this is good. So, and then, you know, House Spirits out of Portland is doing some pretty interesting things. But yeah, I think if you can get the 100% rye spirit correct, as far as grain goes, you know, and I know rye's a trend and all that, but God, it is good.
No arguments there. Why don't we see more 100% rye? I've actually had some listeners sending me emails asking me to talk more about this.
You know, I'm not sure. I know it's a tricky grain. I know it's a sticky grain. You know, when you're...
It's a bear to distill.
It's a bear to distill. And I'm sure, you know, I mean, distillers have sort of always been probably more on the practical side of things. So, you know, when you're ramping up production for something, then maybe that's just not the best way to go. But again, that's one of the interesting things about craft spirit producers is like they're making it at such a small level that they can say, oh, yeah, we can do 100% rye. Why not? Let's throw it in a barrel. Let's see after a year, after two. So, you know, that's what you're going to see. There are spirits going into barrels now that in 3 years are just going to be unbelievable. As long as they have the money
to wait that
to stay
years.
In business yeah. and to wait that 3 years and to, you know, then be able to sell the product at a price that people still want to pay.
Now, the House Spirits you mentioned, those are the guys selling Rogue, right?
House Spirits is in Portland. It's not, no.
Okay, it's not the Rogue guys. Okay, what brand are we finding House Spirits under? Because that's one I'm not familiar with.
House Spirits, they do like 375s and small like apothecary bottles. I think they're just in Portland only. I haven't seen them outside of that area. So.
And they're selling it as House Spirits, or is there a label?
House Spirits.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's
a lot of different products.
That's one of the things, because, I mean, being on the East Coast 99% of the time, I don't hear about the little guys out in Portland unless they show up at someplace like Whiskey Fest or unless I read about them on your blog or in other blogs. Yeah. What new things are coming out that you've heard about that are going to be interesting that people should be looking for in the craft spirits side?
I would say that right now, the thing that I'm most interested in is the sort of staggered release of Koval's white spirits in Chicago that they've aged for a year and some change. I don't know the exact number, but that's all I could get out of them. And I think they've got a millet, they've got a rye, they've got an oat. I know High West is working on an oat single malt whiskey right now. So, you know, that's of interest to me. They're still, I think, tinkering with the recipe.
I've got a sample of that on my tasting table that I'm still trying to find time to taste, but they sent me a sample of that to try. And that's one of the other things these little guys can do is they can try oats, they can try millet, they can because they don't have they don't have to worry about economies of scale and getting bushels of corn by the truckload.
No.
They can crank out something small and try it and see if it works.
Yeah, and then I think, you know, they're probably moving towards some of those grains because the initial white spirit, at least, is a little bit softer. You know, if you're doing a lot of corn, you know, corn's sort of a tough little nut to crack. I mean, literally, it's not like the softest thing in the world. So you have a spirit, you throw on some oak, you've got 4 years to 10 years, and it's pretty good, you know, it's pretty good as bourbon. But when you're talking about white spirits and less time in the barrel, then you might want something softer. And I think that's where, like, the silver oat whiskey that High West did is a great example of that. And then, you know, how will that take to oak? Nobody knows. I mean, that's what's so interesting. It's like you could have 6 months, a year. I mean, the guys are tasting out of the barrels at these craft distilleries right now, and maybe they have some sense of it. But even then, you know, it's kind of a magical thing that you have to – it takes time to figure out.
I almost hesitate to call these guys craft distillers as opposed to the big boys because we have to remember that the big boys all started out as little craft distillers for the most part with one or two stills in a barn somewhere, whether it was in Scotland, Kentucky, or wherever. They didn't start out as big distillers either. These guys all started out experimenting, and some went by the wayside, some merged, some became successful. And the craft guys we're seeing now could be the big boys 50 to 100 years from now. They could be the ones we're talking about as mainstream brands.
I think that's right. You know, and I think the label debate will probably go on. Is it better to call them micro distilleries or artisan spirits or artisan distilleries or craft spirits? You know, I don't know. I put my hands up. My website's American Craft Spirits. So, I mean, that's kind of where I've fallen on it. But, you know, I think however you end up calling them, that people will know what they're doing by what's in the bottle. That's, you know, to me, that's the basic thing, that if you're tasting it and you like it, if it's two guys or if it's like, you know, a whole company, Buffalo yeah. Trace, who cares?
It's the same thing in the beer side. For instance, Samuel Adams finally crossed past that limit to where they couldn't call themselves a craft distillery anymore because they were brewing something like 2 million barrels or whatever a year. Right. In the last year, they're not allowed to compete in the craft brewing competitions anymore. They have to treat themselves as one of the big boys, even though, by all intents and purposes, we'd all consider them a craft distillery, or brewery, rather.
Right. I mean, you know, but then you've got people who... They're huge Sam Adams fans. That's all they'll drink. They like all their new products. And then, you know, compare that to something like Three Floyds, you know, which doesn't run commercials on the Discovery Channel. And, you know, I don't know. To me, it's like there's what's in the bottle. And then, you know, there's all the noise that surrounds it. So clearly Sam Adams benefits by, you know, having people perceive that it's, you know, right, crafted by people or whatever. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's still not that big. And, you know, what, less than $500 million in sales a year or something like that. But if they do a good job, you know, drink it. I mean, hey, Budweiser has its time and place. On a hot day, you want a cold American lager beer. Hey, what's going to be, you know, it's got its place and everything.
It has a place, and that's usually in somebody else's refrigerator, as far as I'm concerned. Okay. But,
but yeah, I mean that's so. But I mean, as a, you know, as a retailer, that's the, I know, that's the attitude that we take.
And it's your bread and butter here.
That's, you know, that's part of it. And, you know, but just like if you went into a random side of the road liquor store in the middle of Kentucky and you saw a bottle of bourbon brand that you had never even heard of before, You might be interested in buying that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you might be interested in buying that. And I think people who care about beer or care about wine, I mean, if you're really into it, you're not going to only drink Arctic Panzer Wolf, you know, mm-hmm. or, you know, Behemoth or whatever, or Hoptimum. I mean, you're going to have to go after, you know, you should open a Budweiser. Heck, why not? I mean, to me,
anything just to compare it to a good beer.
Oh, man.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
You're into a corner now.
I'm sorry. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. That's why this isn't a beer show.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I'm sorry. I just have trouble drinking Budweiser. Too many memories from college. We didn't have natural light back then.
Oh, that's too bad. You didn't have Keystone?
We didn't have Keystone. We had Mickey's.
Ugh. Did you have Pabst? I mean, Pabst is still a classic.
Yeah, PBR. Of course we had PBR, yeah. Which was, and to be fair, it was in the early 80s around here. But the Big Red we're in now did not exist back then here at 8th and College, if I remember correctly. It may have been here since then.
It's
but
15th and College.
It was at 5th. The old one was at 15th right. and College because we used to go pick up kegs in my pickup truck there. The original one, and then the great big Quonset hut down on College Street. Right. Back in the day, which actually had all the big selection, which was the flagship back then. But let's bring this back home again, because has the experience that you've had working on the blog and being able to taste all the micro spirits influenced the way you guys pick spirits to sell here at the store? Have you been able to find stuff that you need to, you go to the boss and say, we need to stock this?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, we started stocking dry fly right around the time that I started. And, you know, a big part of it is getting people interested in it. I mean, if we can't sell it, there's really no point in stocking it. You know, we'd love, you know, could we stock 1,000? I mean, of course. I mean, most stores could do that. You know, they want you, people want you to bring in more product. But, it's a balance between educating consumers and people actually liking the product, and then also, you know, from our perspective, what do we like and what are we passionate about? So those two things are always interacting with one another, and you know, 99% of the time in a really positive way, where, you know, we're saying, well, we like this, and our customer requested that, so we try to meet somewhere in the middle and bring in some pretty good things. But then also educate, like, you know, Dry Fly is not an old whiskey. It's going to have a different,
right?
It's going to have a totally different flavor profile. So, you know, in order to get some people interested in that, you've got to identify your whiskey customers and then say, you know, what did you think? Did you like it? Did you not? What were your expectations of it? I know with Wasmans, for example, right. I mean, expectations are like blown out the door when people try it. And, you know, there are flavors in the Wasmans profile that I really like. And there are some things that I could see somebody who doesn't, I mean, I drink more craft and younger spirits than a lot of people, than right. most people. But, you know, it goes back to educating consumers. You know, 10 years ago, if you put some of these barley wines that are really popular today in front of somebody and ask them to drink it, it'd blow their head off, you know? So that clearly has developed over time. And I think the same thing can happen in spirits.
You'll find links for both Matt's American Craft Spirits blog and Big Red Liquors at the WhiskeyCast website. And since Matt and I discussed the W.H. Harrison Indiana Bourbon, let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with a look at that one. First off, there really is a W.H. Harrison, but with no connection to the whiskey business. William Henry Harrison was a former governor of the Indiana Territory before statehood and became the 9th president of the United States in the election of 1840. He also holds the distinction of being the shortest-serving president in U.S. history. You see, at his inauguration in March of 1841, Harrison refused to wear an overcoat on a very cold and wet day. He gave a 2-hour-long inaugural address that remains the longest ever delivered, and promptly contracted pneumonia. He died 30 days later on April 4th, 1841. The history lesson's over. As for the bourbon, it completed its 4-year term in barrels and is bottled at 40% ABV. It's a bit unusual. You'll find a spearmint note on the nose and a touch of vanilla. The taste is creamy with that same spearmint note and hints of brown sugar and caramel underneath. The finish is short and minty. It's an interesting whiskey. I'd like to try it after a couple of more years in the barrel. I'm scoring the W.H. Harrison Indiana Bourbon an 82. Now, NASCAR's Daytona 500 is this weekend, and back in 1963, Junior Johnson won the 500 just a few years after he was released from a federal prison for making moonshine in North Carolina. Stock car racing in the U.S. was built by former moonshine runners, and Johnson's family had the reputation of making the best moonshine around. Former President Ronald Reagan pardoned Junior Johnson back in 1986, and his story was told in the movie The Last American Hero. Junior Johnson is back in the whiskey business now, legally. He's a part owner of Piedmont Distillers in North Carolina, which makes Junior Johnson's Midnight Moon from his old family recipe. It's only sold in a few states, mostly in the South, but I was able to track some down here in Indiana. Unlike the family recipe, Midnight Moon is bottled at 40% ABV, and while a lot of moonshine is made out of sugar, this is distilled from grains, making it just like other white whiskeys on the market. The nose is crisp and clean, with notes of boiled sweet corn and vanilla. The taste is thick and chewy, and reminds me of fresh boiled corn on the cob with just a bit of pepper. The finish is smooth and lingers with a light sweetness. It's one-dimensional, but it really is very drinkable, and if it's even remotely close to the moonshine Junior Johnson's family made back in the day, I can see how they got their reputation. I'm scoring Junior Johnson's Midnight Moon an 81. Finally, I brought some of the samples from my tasting table with me on this trip, including the New Leaf Erickson bottling from Highland Park that I mentioned last month. Again, it's only available in travel retail and is bottled at 40% ABV. The nose is slightly smoky, with notes of toasted oak, honey, and baked cinnamon apples. The taste is creamy with a nice smokiness and touches of apple pie with brown sugar and cinnamon. The finish has a nice balance of smokiness and spice that lingers nicely. I'm scoring the Highland Park Leif Erickson release an 87. Of course, you'll find all of my tasting notes in the WhiskeyCast apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. The iPhone and iPad version is sponsored by the Glenrothes, and the Android version is sponsored by Ben Romick. They're also available at the WhiskeyCast website. That's also where you'll find links to the WhiskeyCast Facebook page and my Twitter feed, the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast store powered by Amazon.com, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. And my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you this time around from Central Indiana. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.